I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Solo Fiedler joins me now. The acclaimed artist has an upcoming exhibition, Leap and the Loom Will Appear. It begins this Friday, the 21st of September, and runs until Tuesday, the 2nd of October at 1395 Cartwright Street on Granville Island. The medium in which Ms. Fiedler works is tapestry. She is a world-renowned fiber artist whose intricately woven realist tapestries have been collected by various individuals and institutions here and beyond. Beyond being remarkable pieces of art, her tapestries have been produced by procuring yarn from thrift stores and estate sales. She's elevated the idea that reusing and recycling ought to play in our daily lives. I'll get Ms. Fiedler to tell us about her process, about her work, about the marvelous pieces that can be seen in this exhibit, including her 11 by 7.5 foot tapestry of Las Vegas, her tapestries of Salt Lake City and Vancouver, both made around the time of each city hosting the Olympic Games. In particular, the Las Vegas and Vancouver pieces capture a specific time, and their accuracy makes the pieces all the more special as they're documenting history. This exhibit, which begins this week, coincides with the 2018 Textile Society of America Symposium, which is in town the 19th through the 23rd of September. Also, we should note that Ms. Fiedler owned the Soft Rock Cafe in Kitsilano from 1976 to 1983, a legendary spot that hosted many musical acts from here and far. Visit solafiedler.com for more information. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person today, Sola Fiedler. Ms. Fiedler, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
It's such a beautiful morning.
It is, isn't it?
Please call me Sola.
Sola. Thanks for coming in to do this. We talked before we started about your future plans and various travels that you'll be doing in the next few years. Vancouver, has that been home for a long time?
I came back here. I left in 1984 when the Soft Rock was torn down, and I came back in time for the Olympics, the 2010 Olympics, and I fell in love with Vancouver all over again, and I've stayed here since.
Yeah, but in the interim, you have traveled a great deal, haven't you? These, like Salt Lake City and Las Vegas, these places that you've, say, captured in your work.
Yes, mainly because I love to do a tapestry just like the old days when kings commissioned tapestries if they won a war or something like that. I love to celebrate the Olympics, or my very first tapestry was celebrating the fact that Vancouver had Expo 86. Mm-hmm. And so I'm inspired by any kind of celebration. And as you've spoken of the future, as soon as they announced 10 years in advance that they were going to give LA the 2028 Summer Olympics, I thought, and that's where I'll be, July the 30th, in the middle of the Olympics, celebrating my 92nd birthday. That's so exciting. The hairs on my arms are standing on end.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about how you're going to depict Los Angeles, do you have that in your mind already?
I've never been there. It's really exciting. I'm going in a couple of months. Usually, if you ask me what animal I was, I would be an eagle because I love looking at the aerial view of everywhere.
Yeah.
And so in when I did Salt Lake City, I thought I was a 737 because I actually did it from 15,000 feet. And then in Las Vegas, I was a helicopter because you see them flying the tourist up and down the strip all time.
Right.
And then in L.A., I'll be a drone because I can fly easily over the city in my head.
Uh-huh.
I actually don't go up there.
Yeah.
I actually walk around on the ground. Uh-huh. And that's part of my plan to live to be 100. I walk for 2 or 3 hours a day. So I walk to the building that I'm putting in the tapestry. I get the building in my head in a three-dimensional form and take it back and put it in the tapestry the next day. Then usually because I'm working on the building next door, I go back the next day, check that I got the first building right, and think about doing the second one.
Yeah.
Sometimes a building will take 2 weeks, like in Las Vegas, each property or hotel or resort, whatever you want to call them, would take about 2 weeks. For instance, like I put in every floor and every window and every sign. So for the Trump Tower, I was standing outside trying to count the floors, and I kept losing track. So I went in and I asked the concierge, I said, how many floors? And he said, 52. So there are actually 52 floors in my tapestry. Any architect looking at any building I've put in will not be upset because I've copied it exactly.
And that accuracy is important to you. And I mean, historians and architects will probably tell you, no, that's right.
Yeah, because some of these end up in museums, and it is this moment in time. And Las Vegas is really important because I read an article in the New York Sunday Times that they were going to blow up a lot of the old beautiful hotels like the Stardust on the Sahara, all covered in neon and the New Frontier. And they were going to build condominiums on the Strip. And I was horrified. So I raced to Las Vegas and started on my way up the Strip from the Mandalay Bay. And it took me 3 years to get the entire Strip in. And they blew up five beautiful resorts while I was there, and they've blown up six since. So literally, with each passing year, that tapestry becomes more valuable because you'll never see those places again.
Right.
They're gone.
And so we both live in Vancouver. Because the city is changing as quickly as it is, we all have our opinions about what's happening and what should happen and what shouldn't happen. When you look at Vancouver, especially the Vancouver piece that you have, because that is a moment in time that we'll never get back again. When you're working on this stuff, do you feel that you're doing, say, a service in terms of the documenting that you're doing? Because it is important, isn't it, to remember these moments in time?
Yeah, it's important to remember the celebration of that moment in time. I'm not trying to say you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't blow up this hotel or these beautiful old buildings and put in some ugly condominium.
Right.
I guess you get my feelings on that. But I just feel it's my sort of job to document it.
And at the same time, because it's your work, it's also lovely to look at. And I'm sure you get that reaction from people.
And it's lovely to touch. I do all my tapestries with recycled materials. Mm. So before I even get that sweater or that dress or whatever, that I 100 hands have already touched it, then my hands touch it. And I love people to actually come up and touch my tapestries, and especially children. I made in for this show a pod that they can hug, a three-dimensional pod, and it's got all fur and fabrics and beads. And I hope in their imagination maybe they can grow up to be an artist if they fall in love with the color and the shapes. It's very childlike. This occupation is, at first, my very first tapestry, because I don't know how to paint or draw, and I have no training whatsoever. I drew the buildings as if they were little squares, and a five-year-old would do them. And unfortunately, I can't go back there. I can't untrain myself. But I think it was Picasso said, oh, if only I could go back to the way I did things as a child.
And so when people go see Leap and the Loom will appear on Granville Island shortly, they are welcome to touch the pieces there, right?
Yes, they're more than welcome, and children too. And yesterday I did a really interesting interview with a blind reporter, and we were talking about something he couldn't see. So I got the view of someone who couldn't see, and I took his hands all over my tapestries, and we actually videotaped this for 3 hours because it was so interesting, and that will appear. There is apparently a network, AMI, for people with disabilities, and they especially train their reporters, mm-hmm. and they especially, you know, are geared to viewers with disabilities, like not being able to see or hear.
And the reaction from adults who touch the tapestries, as well as children, it's a very tactile experience as well, isn't it?
Yes, and I actually, at the Olympics, I deliberately do the tapestries in public. I pick some very prominent public location, uh-huh. like a shopping mall, and I'll set my loom up, and I stay there for the duration. And people will come every day and check up how far I've been if they live locally.
Yeah.
But I get to chat then to all the Olympic visitors and the Olympic athletes and the members of the IOC. And it's just most artists work in their studio in total privacy because they don't want people to see their mistakes.
Yeah.
And I put the Sydney Bridge in, all 28 struts of it, the
yeah.
vertical struts. It took me 3 weeks, and a security guard walked by, and he said, you know, that's not the right color of the bridge. And he was right. And so I had to undo the whole thing and put it all back in the right color. And you know, I just... I don't mind making mistakes in public,
yeah.
but most artists don't want to be seen making yeah. mistakes.
But isn't that wonderful, too, that you're able to interact with someone and they can help you along the way?
Right. And yeah. people don't know how time-consuming tapestry is, but when they come one day and see me working and they come back the next day and I've only done, like, 2 square inches because it's so fine work,
uh-huh.
they understand that this is... This is not like painting or taking a photograph.
Yeah.
You have to commit to it. If you start a tapestry and you know it's going to take 2 or 3 years, usually I put my name in first and then I put the date when I plan to be finished. And this does not always work out. I had 2007 on the Vegas tapestry, but in 2008, when I thought I would finish it, the whole financial collapse in the United States
yeah.
made sure that I wouldn't get to sell it. So I thought, okay, I'll stay another year. And because I think Trump has money and Steve Wynn has money, and they were all building new resorts at
yeah.
the time, I stayed and put them all in. So I didn't actually finish it until 2009. So I don't always get the date right.
Yeah, but it's a good goal, isn't it?
But once you commit to
yeah.
it,
yeah.
there's no turning back, you
yeah.
know, not for me anyway.
You mentioned colors earlier, so if you, I'm assuming that you have a great stash of say, yarn
oh.
and such, so you know what you need in terms of colors, and if you're at a thrift shop, say, and you see a sweater that's a particular color, you get that because you'll need that, say, later.
Yeah, I probably make 4 trips a week to Value Village or Salvation Army or the St. Vincent de Paul,
mm-hmm.
and like, for instance, the other day I had to make a quick run to the Salvation Army. I needed a white t-shirt for the one I'm working on, and I didn't have any white t-shirts. I normally would think white was boring, but
mm-hmm.
I actually needed white, and so yeah, that's my source, and luckily the Salvation Army is only 1 block away.
Yeah. So you would never, say, dye the yarn
no,
yourself,
I did,
right?
I did once for one huge tapestry. I dyed 150 T-shirts by throwing them all in the washing machine because I needed
yeah.
colors like terracotta, and that's not a T-shirt color.
Right.
I was doing a tapestry of Taos, the Pueblo in New Mexico,
mm.
and I needed many shades of terracotta, so I would throw all these T-shirts in, and they'd all come out different colors because they'd been washed and worn different
mm.
periods of time. You do whatever you have to do to get the color you want.
Yeah. Well, how are you then with your own clothing? I mean, in what you buy, in terms of what you
oh,
wear?
I live in recycled clothing. My entire clothing budget is about $25 a year. But I grew up during the war in London, and we had the boats, the merchant ships, weren't getting through. They were being torpedoed. So we had to keep recycling our clothing, our furniture, everything, because nothing was coming in. So we learned to, the, you know, unpick the grown-ups' clothing to make the children's clothing, uh-huh. unravel the sweaters to knit socks and gloves, because we didn't have knitting machines then. Everything had to be done by hand. So I learned to do everything by hand and grew to love it. And I'm very comforted by sitting and knitting, actually. In the evenings, I sit and knit two little warm little hats for people who live in Canada.
Yeah.
And, actually, then if I wholesale those two little hats, that pays my rent and my food. And I can risk the whole day on doing a tapestry that might not sell for 10 years.
Mm.
So I pretty well can go anywhere in the world and ship my little hats back to Vancouver, and the local boutique owners, bless them, will sell yeah. them and send me the money, and I can just keep going.
Yeah. What, in terms of the tools that you use, other than yarn, which we've already touched on, is it a lot of stuff that you have to carry with you wherever you go?
No, I lived for about 30 years in one small suitcase that you put in the overhead rack,
mm-hmm.
and I would go to each city and go to the local thrift store and buy everything I needed, like my coffee pot and anything like that. And all I really need is darning needles and a pair of scissors. And I used to say I can earn a living anywhere in the world with a pair of scissors. and that's true.
Yeah.
I didn't even need the little suitcase.
Yeah. Yeah. What, can anyone weave?
Yes, it's just darning in and out of these vertical threads. I can teach like a four-year-old to weave in a few minutes. And because they might not have the motor controls to control a needle, we would just put it a piece of fabric onto a tongue depressor and staple it on,
mm.
and they weave in and out with the tongue depressor. So it's so simple, but not many people would commit to the time it takes.
Yeah, and it must one must have patience to do
oh,
it.
I've got incredible patience. And also, if a building isn't the right color, or I've done something the wrong color, and I look at it the next day and I think, oh, that's 1/8 of an inch too wide or something, I'm just happy to unpick it and do it over again.
Yeah. But once it's done, and when we go to Granville Island these next couple of weeks, and we see the various pieces, I mean, is there a feeling where you want to change something, say, or when it's done, it's done?
No, when it's done, it's done. There's
yeah.
nothing more I can do. The city may change, but my tapestry stays the same.
Yeah. How many pieces will we see at Granville Island?
There's 17 pieces. 16 of them are for sale. The tapestry that is coming back for the people to see is the Vancouver tapestry. It was bought by a lady who donated it to the Canuck Children's Hospice.
Mm-hmm.
So it disappeared, actually, out of public view. So for the people who've never seen it, it's really worth coming to have a look
yeah.
at. And if anyone wants to see it again, it's down there for 2 weeks.
Yeah. What I read on your website, the various institutions and the people that own your work.
Yes.
Is that hard for you because you've spent so much time with the piece itself to let it go?
Oh, no, not at all. First of all, I love it when a public institution takes it because then I can share it.
Mm.
And really, the best part is sharing when I've finished it. But then I need to let it go so that I can go and work on the next piece. And I really love to share my work with people. So I must admit, when in the past, I have turned down magnificent offers for my tapestries because people wanted to put it in their home and no one would ever see it again.
Mm.
The Key West tapestry, which I finished, I think, in 1986, I waited 12 years. I got wonderful offers, like one Santa Barbara couple was going to put it in their bedroom and so forth. But then there was a huge hurricane, and we were in Atlanta, so we threw all our tools in the truck and went down to help them with repairs. And I put the tapestry in the airport. This was 12 years after I'd finished it. Mm-hmm. And I did a run of 2,000 posters so that I could sell them and give the money to the relief efforts. But I did put a sign up that the tapestry was for sale. And I got that wonderful call from a man who said, "I'm not a very rich man. What's the least you'll take for the tapestry if I donate it immediately to the museum?" Mm. Which meant it would be in public for forever. And that was, and literally, it was in the museum that afternoon.
Really?
I was so happy.
Yeah.
And then with the money, I was able immediately to, and I had wanted to do the Sydney tapestry, but I didn't have enough money to go and live in Australia for 2 years. That fate sent me the money.
Yeah.
Literally, I was like on the plane next day to Sydney, ready to go with the Sydney tapestry. It's amazing how life hands you just what you need.
What will fascinate people solely listening to us is the way you look at life. And you mentioned a moment ago about the experience growing up during the Second World War in England, and how you're forced by circumstance to be thrifty. What do you say to people nowadays who are so consumed with materialistic behavior, with consumerism, where it's very easy for us to buy, say, a piece of clothing and shed that and get something new very quickly?
I'm really horrified by, I saw a documentary that was done on the Salvation Army. It was on the CBC. On these huge bales of clothing that they're unable to sell. They're only able to resell about one-tenth of the stuff that's donated to them. And then it goes to third world countries, and even they are going, have too much, yeah. And they burn it in their landfills. And all I can do, I can't lecture people, but I can show them by the way I live, mm-hmm. and that's my kind of small contribution. And if I can show kids, and I would love to teach at Arts Umbrella or somewhere like that, kids to recycle their clothing into art, and how you can actually make a living at that, and you can do something beautiful that will last forever.
And are you hopeful that people will get the message that's say driven your life and maybe do the same in their own lives?
Well, even if it only makes them pause and think a moment or two, but as long as if they've finished with something, they donate it, and at least, you know, we've got some very professional people at Value Village and so forth, it has turned into a really professional business, mm-hmm. these thrift stores.
Yeah.
They're very nice to go into. They're very well laid out and very well cared for, and it's quite a pleasure. And for me, it's a lot of fun because I find really inspiring sweaters, mm-hmm. and clothing that I can cut up that you certainly can't buy in a yarn store.
Yeah,
you know, we can, because people now come from all over the world and bring clothing with them from India and so forth. Now, this is not being sold in stores, but they're bringing it and they leave it behind.
Yeah.
So I have access literally to
the world.
From all over, yeah. the world by just going to a thrift store. Now, you're not going to get that in the department store because they only have a very limited amount of stuff that they want to sell.
Yeah. Well, we talked before we started recording about the Soft Rock Cafe. And what a special place that is. I was one when it closed, so I obviously have only heard about it and read about it online and interviews that you've done with, say, Cheryl McKay and Grant Lawrence on it. One wonders if you'll expand on that, maybe write a book, say, about that place.
I'm not sure that writing a book is the right way to go. Once things have gone, they've gone in that respect. It was a wonderful time to have a 500-seat coffee house with no alcohol that the kids could come to and see their favorite singer-songwriters up close, or bands, or whatever. I had four coffee houses in Yorkville in the 60s, so I knew most of the performers really well in the 60s. And when I moved to Vancouver and I saw this lovely old wooden building, there was no way any bank or anyone would lend me any money, for instance, because there were no coffee houses here. This town ran on alcohol, and they said, everybody said, you put alcohol in there, we'll give you all the money you want.
Right.
But I did it with the help of the contractors, and we got it open, and it was a wonderful 7 years.
And I think you told Grant Lawrence that at a certain point, you just have to let that go, because I mean, I guess you did know early on that it was going to be for 7 years, right? Or roughly.
It was 7 years. Yeah. The landlord said, "You can have it for 7 years and do anything you like with it, but then I'm tearing it down and building." It's where Y Yoga is now, and C-Fun radio station used to be right opposite, which is now the Salvation Army. Kitsilano was very different than maybe back in those days. On any given block, there might be only two storefronts that were occupied. It was a pretty empty street, very lifeless. Uh-huh. And then when the soft rock came along, the whole street would be filled with people because we were open from 8 o'clock in the morning until midnight. And there would be people coming and going all the time. Yeah. And it was especially good for people who had problems with alcohol, because they could come and socialize and be perfectly safe. I think at one point all my staff belonged to AA, but it was a very safe place for them to work.
Yeah, and then I'm astonished to hear that in the late 70s, people weren't drinking coffee like they are now.
Well, we weren't so aware that coffee kept you awake, but there were lots of alternatives. There was tea, which the people from Quebec really loved, and you could have hot apple cider or hot lemonade if it was a cold night, and we know mostly Vancouver is cold. And we had a huge deck, and in the summer you could go out and have an ice cold lemonade, and of course, if you were dancing your buns off, because I had a huge dance floor and brought in as many bands as I could. The good thing about it, too, was we supported so many musicians with regular gigs, and we paid them very well because we had 500 seats. Mm-hmm. And I was much more concerned about paying the bands well, because I knew how difficult it is for musicians to earn a living. And now we have a lot of places like Bird on a Wire and so forth, and that supports 240 artists and craftspeople and makers, and makes sure that they can pay their rent. And that's a beautiful thing about Vancouver, I think. There are so many boutiques where the owners are supporting young designers and young craftspeople. There's nowhere quite like it in the world, because somebody has to take responsibility for these organizations. And on Granville Island particularly, there's all kinds of people, you know, who are able to practice their craft. I just love going to Granville Island.
Yeah, every kind of art is there. I mean, but potters and weavers.
And the jewelry stores, for instance, support maybe 100 jewelers.
Yeah.
And the dress stores, like the one that sells my hats, Wendy at Little Dream, she supports 200 designers of purses and clothing. And very often they get their start with these boutiques, and they go on to greater things in New York or L.A., but they got their start in one of these lovely little boutiques.
Yeah.
And this is such a lovely ground to plant your seeds in.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I mean, we talked a moment ago about how the city's changing and how expensive it is. I mean, as an artist, and you've been able to do it for a number of years now, to live here as an artist, What do you tell young people so that they're not discouraged? Because the challenge of making a living, getting your rent paid for a lot of people is turning them off the art, say.
Well, I think you have to follow your dream. First of all, you have to have a dream. And there is a saying, life is a parade.
Mm-hmm.
2% are in the parade, 8% are watching the parade, and 90% are standing on the wrong corner and don't know there's a parade. So I've been mapping out the parade routes for a long time. I'm usually way ahead of the game. But I think you have to have a dream, and so therefore you have to think, I want to be in the parade. And then if you can make your dream come true, you are in the parade. And that's Maslow's self-actualization triangle.
Uh-huh.
But for many people, they don't know what they want, and it's really difficult. And they settle for something that... If you have a dream, you've got to be prepared to sacrifice for it, to fight for it, to suffer setbacks. They do say that when you make decisions, you're right 55% of the time and you're right wrong 45% mm-hmm. of the time. Well, I'll settle for that 5% of being
yeah.
on the right track.
Yeah.
And it's something I think maybe that's probably what casinos make.
That's probably right, yeah.
But it's enormously helpful because there are setbacks. Like if I do a tapestry and it doesn't sell for 10 years,
yeah.
and I'm holding on to it,
yeah.
you know, that's a bit tough.
Yeah. How what's your day like in terms of how often, how long you work, say?
Well, I get up, I get up really early at 4 or 5 o'clock, and I finish off the hats that I was too tired to finish off and sew up and decorate the night before. And then I go into whatever project I'm working on during the day. I exercise and in the middle of the day. I take a nap at 3 o'clock, and then I go out to the thrift stores to see or you know, run errands.
Mm-hmm.
And then I come back and I work for 4 hours making 2 little hats. So I brush my teeth at 10:30 and go to bed. And I'm just so excited about life. I just wish there were 36 hours in every day.
Right. Yeah.
I can't wait to get up and get going on, you know, whatever project I'm working on.
Yeah. What are the challenges, though, when you're working on a tapestry? I mean, in terms of lighting, do you have to make those considerations? Your hands, if they're tired, or
there are pretty well no challenges, except halfway through the Vancouver tapestry, I froze one of my shoulders because of repetitive stress syndrome, and it takes 5.5 months, so it really set me back to get movement back in my
yeah.
arm. And then instead of working 8 hours a day, I cut it down to 2 hours because I was scared it would happen again. And so it took me a lot longer to do the tapestry. I do have to be aware that my little hands can only do so many repetitive movements, whether it's crochet or knitting
uh-huh.
or weaving or sewing. And I run the risk of freezing a shoulder.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty well the only risky thing in it.
Yeah. But you take great care of yourself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so there's a lesson in there for us who are listening to this in terms of, I mean, you mentioned making it to 2028 in Los Angeles.
Yes.
I mean, what's the regimen say for you?
Well, I eat a very healthy diet. I haven't eaten sugar or salt or fat for 40 years since Dr. Pritikin came out with his heart diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately cottoned on to that and felt 100% better. I actually opened a restaurant in Key West. I converted the oldest Jewish synagogue in Florida into a restaurant with the opposite of what most restaurants, which have more sugar and more salt mm-hmm. and more fat. And it was a huge success. And it still is 30 years later. I think if people, you know, I have huge goals that are very exciting. And that's what makes it worthwhile. Mm. I was in a grocery store the other day and I'm filling up this bag to the very top with broccoli. And this young man is standing beside me and he said, "That's a lot of broccoli." And I said, "Part of the plan." And he said, "What plan?" And I said, "It's my plan to live to be 100. Yeah. And he got it right away.
Yeah.
But he was not buying broccoli.
What I have admired of you, because we've only met today, but I've known about you for a number of years, is just how much enjoyment you're getting out of your work and talking about your work as well and sharing it with people, and as they will shortly here on Granville Island be able to see it.
Well, I think when you see the work, you'll get it immediately. You'll walk into this 1,500-square-foot gallery, and it will be filled with color and sparkle and life. And I'm afraid a lot of art, when you walk into a gallery, is gray and depressing. And I was doing an interview, and it is wonderful to do interviews because the interviewer asks you questions, and you have to answer questions you would never have thought to ask yourself, right? And so I'm doing this video with The Courier, uh-huh. right? Our Courier.
Yeah.
And you can go online and see this video. And the videographer said, "Why is there..." And we were surrounded, right, with color. And so,
yeah.
"Why is all this sparkle and color?" And then I remembered, as a teenager, my whole reason for being was a ballroom dancer, and I had all these lovely costumes that I made with matching satin slippers that were dyed exactly to match. And every night I went ballroom dancing. And when I came to Canada in 1959, I had a suitcase full of outfits like I was going to go on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
And I actually didn't have anything else. I had all these dancing costumes and $6, and that's how I arrived in Canada. So it's just going back to the things I loved as a teenager, and so that's kind of very honest, because you mm-hmm. haven't been corrupted by
the
rest
workplace of the
world. And what you have to do for a living. Of course, I couldn't earn a living as a ballroom dancer, especially in Canada. But, you know, now I can earn a living with all the sequins I want.
Yeah. Well, long may it continue. It's been such a pleasure to meet you and to talk to you. I can't wait for the piece on Los Angeles, because it's a city that's fascinated me for a long time. It's a city that I think a lot of people put down because, it's the artifice of Hollywood and so forth. But it's a very real city at the same time with great diversity. And I think you'll find great enjoyment as you continue your work there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of visual treats in store, like the concert hall, Gary's concert hall, mm-hmm. to the iconic Hollywood sign, and it's a showbiz town,
yeah.
So they are going to put on the most wonderful, glamorous Olympics, right?
Yeah.
With all the sequins and neon that life can provide. I will be in heaven.
Yeah, well, I wish you all the best. Thanks for this.
Could I correct just one thing?
Sure.
I think you said the address wrong. It's 1359 Cartwright Street on Granville Island.
Got it. Yeah, I'll fix that in the intro.
Okay.
But solofiedler.com is the website for more. Leap and the Loom will appear. Is the exhibit the 20th of September through to the 2nd of October, 1359 Cartwright Street on Granville Island. Solofiedler, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.